Good morning. So last time we were talking a bit about stacks, starting with some applications, including probably the most notable one of a postfix calculator, which comes up on this week's lab a bunch. So hopefully that's useful. And go through some other examples. So we showed our example of a postfix calculator, where we got to evaluate a mathematical expression. And this is something that's, we have this form here where we basically just go through it directly and calculate an expression, which is not as easy as if we've had it in this normal infix form, where we would have to figure out how to evaluate all the parentheses and do all the operator precedence. But another thing stacks are useful for is when you do have to take that infix form and actually turn it into either the postfix form or otherwise evaluate it, many of the common algorithms for doing so are in fact going to use a stack. And conceptually, what you want to do is you want to keep track of, well, I'm this far in the string, what operators haven't I finished yet? And the stack is the right type of structure to keep track of that, because the one that started most recently is the one which is probably going to finish first. And another big example of stacks that we'll see later in the semester is tracking function calls, especially recursive function calls, where we need to keep track that we have all these calls, in this case to fib, going on and a call to main. And in fact, we don't just need to keep track that we're calling fib. We want to know about the argument, any of the local variables. We want to know where, when we return, where that's going to go in the code. And in our machines, this is all kept track of by having an actual stack that keeps track of all the active function calls and the variables and the functions and so on. Okay, so we've talked about what stacks are useful for. We have a bunch of use cases, and there's more I can't think of. And one question is then, okay, how can we implement it? In the lab, we just started you off where we say, oh, the C++ standard library has an implementation, but there's multiple ways that that implementation could work, and later on we're gonna have you write an implementation. And so there's lots of choices that can work. So probably the simplest choice is singly linked lists. And for singly linked lists, we're going to basically have our list start at the top of the stack. And the reason for that is that we want it to be the case that, well, when the stack is empty, we're going to find out we have the head of our list is empty. And when it's not, all our operations manipulate that top of the stack. So we're going to want it to be the case that we look at the head, and this is always the node we want to be changing. Either we want to push something to replace it, or we want to pop it, or we want to look at its value. All our operations are going to look at the head of this linked list, and so that's why we have the head be the top. So for example, if we push another value, it becomes the top of the stack. We were inserting at the head. So here, all our operations are pretty simple to implement. Is empty, it's just, is our head null? Do we have an empty list? Top is get the value at the head, assuming it's not null. If it's null, in a production implementation, maybe you'd throw an exception. Push is create a new linked list node, have it replace the head, set its next pointer to where the head is. And pop is delete the head and set the new head to where the head's next pointer was. So this is one option for implementing a stack. And you might think that this is the most straightforward option and what you would do. It is in fact, though, not what the C++ standard library is doing. So another option, which is still not what the C++ standard library is doing, but has some advantages, is we could use a vector. And we could just say the last element of this vector is the top of the stack. And the reason we'll choose the last element and not the first, we could have chosen the first, is because we know manipulating at the end of a vector is going to be fast compared to manipulating at the beginning, at least for things like removing the last thing in a vector is pretty fast. Removing the first thing in the vector typically involves copying everything over one to move every value over by one. So we'll have everything at the end. So then our implementations are also straightforward. When we check if it's empty, we're asking, is the vector empty? When we're checking, when we're pushing a value, we use pushback, the append method of a vector. And when we pop a value, we use popback, which is the remove last element method, which is the same as resizing the vector to have one less size. So, any questions about how we implement this with vector? So, this is fairly straightforward. So, why would we prefer to use vector over linked list? Is there an advantage? Is there not? Yeah. So you might say, well, the vector seems more compact. We just have an array of values. We're in a linked list. We allocate some new space, which might be far away from everything else. And we also have all this overhead for tracking pointers between each of these little spaces we allocated. So that's an argument why maybe vector would be a more efficient way of doing this. Yeah.
It's much faster to check the size of the stack.
So you think it's probably faster to check the size of the stack for which case? Okay, so if we want to know the size, it would be faster. Now, with this interface, that's not actually a concern because we have no way of actually asking for the size. We can only ask if it's empty. But you might think maybe that's an operation you want to add to the stack, even though it's not a normal operation. Yes. Okay, so these are, in fact, all sort of valid implementations. And so then we have the advantages and disadvantages of them. I'll skip over this. And the other thing we could do is we could implement it with just a plain array. So we could have a push operation where we track the index of the top element, similar to how the vector we just assume it's at the end. Here we just track the index since we can't resize an array. And we place x at that index, and we push. After incrementing it, top reads from that index, pop, decrements the index, and we have to figure out what we're doing when the array is full, which is either probably, say, throwing an exception, saying, sorry, I only support stacks that don't get too big, or resizing, or making a new array that's bigger. So these are sort of three possible implementations with advantages and disadvantages. And in fact, none of these are what standard stack is using. Standard stack is based on something they call a double-ended queue, which is similar to the vector implementation, but a little bit more, uses something that's a little bit more flexible than a vector, but works in a similar way. It's based on basically two dynamic arrays instead of one. Or I guess one dynamic, it's based on dynamic arrays, but it doesn't require things to start at the beginning of them. Okay, so any questions about stacks? Okay, so there's a very related idea to stacks, which is queues. So queues are very similar set of operations, but instead of always manipulating a top, we're going to have a front and a back. And when we add things, we're going to always add to the back. And when we remove things, we're always going to remove from the front. And the names front and back come from, you can think of this as a line. That when we add things, we're adding it going at the end of the line. When we remove things, we're removing someone from the front of the line. And conceptually, this is just a stack where we've changed where the push operation acts or where the pop operation acts. So a stack was last in, first out. We get back the thing we just put in. A queue is first in, first out. We get back the thing that was put in furthest back in time. And for both of these, we have linked list and array-based implementations, which are similar to what we saw for the stack. We just have to do something different. For the linked list implementation, a singly linked list is going to be a lot less natural because we want to get at both ends, where both the head and the tail. That's a little less nice for the standard singly linked list, or at least a singly linked list where we only track the head. But the same ideas apply, that fundamentally we have a list and we can use one of these data structures we know for implementing a list. And there's going to be advantages and disadvantages, and they're going to be similar to the ones we had for our stack implementation. And queues are another very common data structure, and probably the reasons why you'd want a queue are a bit more obvious than the reasons why you'd want a stack. That, you know, we have things which are just naturally lines. Like you have a printer, a bunch of people are trying to print to it, you want to have them wait in line, you probably don't want to use a stack for that. You want it to be that the person who started printing earliest gets to print first, not the person who started printing most recently gets to print first. When you have like a web server, you get too many requests to handle at once, you want to have them wait in line, you want to serve them in the order that they were requested, so hopefully most users don't wait too long for their web browser to load the page. So let's talk about implementing a queue with an array, let's say. So this is a little trickier than the case of our stack because we have to track two places. We're going to have a front and a back, and we're going to track the index of the front and the back. And like with the stack-based implementation of the queue, since we're tracking the index of these places, we're not using the entire array. And that makes sense because we often don't have as many things in the queue as the size of our array. So here I have a queue class where I have a dynamically allocated array, which I have a pointer to, called data. I keep track of its size because when I use new, it's not going to remember that for me in a way I can access. It probably knows, but won't tell me. And I have the index of the front and the back. And when I enqueue something, I'm going to add it to the back. So I'm going to increment the back index. I'm going to need to do something special if I've run out of space, which I'm not going to show here, but you can think of options like throwing an exception, or which probably isn't actually a good idea, or doing something to resize the array or something like that. And then after I figure out the index, I add the value. And for dequeuing, I check if the queue is empty, which I can know by, do the front index and back index actually, are they, you know, different places. And otherwise, I take the value from the front and move the front index forward. This idea makes sense. So what would be a good idea of a thing to do here? where we run out of space in our queue, we're trying to insert something, and we're at the end of the array. So one idea is to wrap around. Okay, so that's one thing we could do. So yes, wrapping around is an option. There's some trickiness there, which is that what happens if we go over where the front is? But there are real queues which are implemented in that sort of way. But yeah, they have to be careful about making sure the front and back don't overlap. Yes? Question?
Can you put like data size equals to back index minus front index?
So you want to make the data size be, you want to expand the array or just?
Because we changed the data size here.
Okay, so you want to change the data size. So what I said is that our data size was keeping track of how much space we allocated. So that's fine as long as when we change the data size, we also actually allocate a new array for data and copy things to it. But that's another very viable option. Yes? Yeah, so we can reallocate the memory. In C++, the way you do that is by newing the memory and newing memory into a pointer, deleting the old pointer, and replacing the pointers. I note that a tricky issue with the idea of just reallocating the array is we do probably want to actually change the front index if we do that. And the reason why is otherwise the front index will just keep going forward and we'll be not using the beginning of a larger and larger part of the array, and we'll eventually run out of space if we just like imagine that we enqueue, dequeue, enqueue, dequeue over and over again. But when you have to reallocate the array, it would be a natural time to change the front index to zero and move everything in the array. So this is a viable implementation of a queue. There's a bunch of bookkeeping to make it work, but we can do that. Another, perhaps more straightforward implementation is just a linked list that our front and back are exactly a head and tail. We just allocate nodes one at a time. And our enqueue acts at the front, is insert at front, or sorry, insert at back. Our dequeue is removed from front. And you know, you've already implemented this, hopefully. And like with our vector-based implementation of stack versus our our linked list-based one, there's going to be advantages and disadvantages of both of these approaches, which will change which one we might actually want to use. And they're perhaps a bit more pronounced here because even though like the storage for the array-based implementation seems more compact, the bookkeeping is clearly a little more awkward. So this gives us to a concept of the abstract data type. And this is something we'll talk about a lot in this class since we're talking about data structures. And the idea is that an abstract data type is, you know, some kind of data and a set of operations, like a type. Int is a type, we have some data, and there's operations we can do on an int. This is just a general idea of that, where we have data, typically some collection of things like multiple items and a set of operations that we can perform on that. And the idea of having this concept is that this set of operations and data, we can hide the implementation details. All we care about is that we have these operations. So like in stack, we had push, pop, top is empty. We don't care how they're implemented, and we can imagine that there are multiple implementations of these. So when we're using a library that exposes some idea of an abstract data type, we're just going to know about these operations. The library is not going to tell us how it's implementing it. This means that the library can change. If the library writer discovers, you know, I can write a really efficient queue that's based on an array, and they were previously using a linked list, they can do that. And no one who uses the library needs to know that. They just recompile and suddenly things are more efficient. It also means that as a user, if you write code against this abstract data type, you can choose between multiple implementations. So for example, the C++ standard library actually has multiple implementations of stack, and you can choose which one you want based on the advantages and disadvantages of them. So abstract data type is a general concept about, you know, certain, we have some abstraction where we have this set of operations that surround some data. And there's multiple implementations of these. So a class is one way of exposing an abstract data type, and probably the most common way we'll use in this course. But we still have abstract data types, even if we don't have a language which supports classes. Like, if you just have a collection of functions which takes a type you don't look inside of, that's an abstract data type, right? It serves all the same purposes, even though we don't have a language abstraction supporting that. The important thing is that you still get the attributes you expect, that you don't look in the implementation, and all you care about is that it represents a bunch of data, you pass it to these operations, and you could swap out the implementations, you know, without changing your code. You aren't depending that this is a queue implemented with the linked list that never comes up in your code that uses the queue. And we've seen a bunch of examples of abstract data types so far. So stacks and queues are both that. They have a small set of operations that surround some data, which is basically an ordered set of items. And we also have seen lists. Lists are basically, like you've implemented in lab, are an abstract data type. You have a set of operations, and we had you, I think, implement them with a linked list. But there's actually nothing about the interface you're exposing publicly that requires you to implement with a linked list. You could have, except, you know, gotten rid of the list node class and provided the same interface with an iterator type and had everything implemented with something that looked like a vector. Yeah?
Is abstract data type different from abstract data structure?
The question is abstract data type different from abstract data structure? Essentially, no. I don't believe we use the term abstract data structure, so stop, but if you read abstract data structure, they mean essentially the same thing, or probably exactly the same thing. Okay. So, yeah. The AATs we've seen are fundamentally defined by this set of operations. They say that lists are one we've seen, so I haven't really actually concretely told you what are the operations in a list. And we've kind of been wishy-washy about what things a list supports. You have one idea of what those operations are if you just look at what are the public methods in the list class we had you implement in lab. That's one notion of what they are. But we've sort of also talked informally about other things which implement lists, like the C++ containers. But you can think fundamentally the code you had for the lab and maybe some other operations are what you think of being as things you expect a list type to implement. That's the collection of operations, and you'd use a library which supplies a list, and for these thing operations, you wouldn't actually know how it's implemented or can. So here you have a list type, you know, and we have an iterator type. And you've probably traditionally thought of iterators as being like, well, an iterator that's like a pointer to a linked list node that maybe makes less sense with something like an array. But you just defined an iterator type. You didn't let the user look at what was inside it. Like when you're writing code that used your list normally, you didn't look at the iterator.current. You just used the iterator asked it to advance or go previous. So on a linked list, this iterator type is probably a pointer to a linked list node. If we have something like an array, it's probably the index, and maybe a pointer to the array. Both of them serve the same purpose. It's a very different style of implementation, but they're both equally valid, and you can do all the operations with either. And you know, all these other operations you can definitely implement with either style of list, and possibly even other types of lists we haven't talked about. Because fundamentally, when you're thinking about a list, what you're thinking about is just that I have some values, I can get iterators to any of them or past any of them, and there's some, like, I can find one of them, I can insert them, I can remove them. Those are the sorts of operations we're thinking about. So when we're talking about different implementations of an abstract data type, we're going to say, well, we have these operations. You know, what is best for me? And there's going to be these trade-offs. And most commonly, when we have something like a list, the trade-offs are going to be considerably less obvious than our stack or queue cases. And with the stack and queue, yeah, there's advantages to linked list or arrays, but actually it mostly turns out that arrays are more efficient, but probably a little harder to write the code to deal with, like memory allocation and things like that. But they're pretty close, especially asymptotically, as we'll talk about later in the course. With lists, we get this thing where finding something by an index, if we really want to do that, yeah, you can do that with a linked list, but it's substantially less efficient. Finding something in an array, that's real fast. Finding something in a linked list, we have to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 until we get to the kth element. Inserting in the middle of an array, well, that's going to be slow with an array because we have to copy everything after it to somewhere else. With a linked list, if we have, as long as we have an iterator there, we've already found where we want to insert, it's fast. So you have these sorts of trade-offs, but it's the same interface. And you could imagine, as someone using this, that you would write the same code and then you realize, well, which of these operations do I care about being fast? And you choose the one where all those operations were the faster one, where, you know, if you really cared about inserting somewhere in the middle, you'd use a linked list. If you really cared about getting the kth element, you use an array. And it maybe if you had a different mix of operations, you'd use a different type of list. Okay, so any questions about this idea of choosing between data types? Okay. And so the C++ standard library kind of provides this abstract data type thing. But unlike what you might be used to in Java, there's not really a formal thing in the language saying, this is the list data type. So in Java, you'd expect, well, there should be an interface that's like list. That does not exist in the C++ standard library. But there's a set of operations which are the same on all these types of containers. What the C++ standard library calls sequence containers, they all have an iterator type. They have begin, end, front, back. Begin and end return iterators, front and end return elements. They have empty, they have size, clear, insert, erase, push back, and pop back. So all these operations you can think of as the C++ notion of what the list abstract data type is. And if you write code with templates, you can have a template where you take in any of these types and use whatever, and use these operations, and you just can choose what you put in that template based on what you think is most appropriate for your application. And in fact, standard stack works this way. So, right. So in standard stack is actually a template which takes not only the type of thing to have a stack of, but what you want to implement the stack with. And that's how it's implemented. It's implemented based on a list, and you can provide any list type and it will use that. So, any questions on this? So this is our basically finishing up what we're talking about for lists. We're going to go back to data structures later, and naturally we'll kind of go back to thinking about lists when we're thinking about things that are more complicated than lists that have other operations we might care about when we start talking about trees. First, I'm going to talk a bit about some stuff in the C++ standard library that comes up in the lab this week. And next, we're going to talk about numbers. So we're going to go below this high-level stuff about lists and talk about bits. So C++ standard library stuff. So standard string is a class. For the most part, you can think of standard string as basically a vector of characters that happens to be outputted as a string. It has a few additional operations. So that's notably, you can assign a string constant to it or add a string constant to one, which vector char won't let you do. You can convert it to what is called a C-style string, which is basically a pointer to a character array with the C-string method. So if you see a function which expects a C-style string or a pointer to a character array, this is how you get one from a string. The pointer is valid as long as the string still exists. So don't make a string as a local variable and return that C string. Then you have a pointer to somewhere in the string that doesn't exist anymore when the function returns. There's operations like substring. And string also implements equality and less than, which does a lexicographical comparison the same way comparing strings in Java in that sort of way would do. So string constants in C++, we kind of glossed over, are these C-style strings. They're pointers to character arrays which have a null character at the end. Generally, do not compare string constants to each other, including string constants you've struct as the pointer to a character array in a variable. That's going to compare the addresses of the pointers. And you can have the same string stored at multiple locations in memory. And when you have multiple instances of the same constant, the compiler may or may not put them in the same place. It has the option to do so, but it might not figure out that they're the same, especially if they're from different files. You can safely assign strings from string constants and compare strings, C++ strings to string constants. That's fine, and that's because the string class has an operator override for equals, which does the right thing in those cases. So the only problem is if you're comparing two pointers, that actually compares the pointer addresses. But if you're comparing a pointer and a string, one of these operator equals will be called and will do the right thing. Okay. Any questions about strings? Yes?
Is there an easy way to split a string by a certain delimiter?
Is there an easy way to split a string by a certain delimiter? Probably not without C++11 stuff, which I don't think we guarantee is supported. Or it depends on what you call easy, but probably not the level of easy you're used to in Java. Probably the simplest thing is there is a dot index, and dot substring is probably about as close as you can get. But I don't think there's something which will give you a vector of strings, which is probably what you really want with one line. But I could be wrong. I don't do C++ string manipulation very often. Okay, another note is on how IO streams like CN deal with failures, including reaching the end of file. So CN, by default, you can make it throw exceptions. You probably don't want to do that because we haven't talked about how you catch exceptions. But you can make it throw exceptions. By default, it doesn't. So when it experiences an error, it just doesn't do anything. And you can query it later on to see if it had an error by trying to use the CN object itself as a true or false value, Or there's some methods like cn.fail, which query did this fail. So the common thing you'll see is you can read in a value, and then you say if cn did fine, is doing okay, I read in that value, otherwise some sort of error happened at some point. And you can use methods to query what kind of errors happened. Did we reach the end of the file, which is what control D does, or did something else happen? Yes?
Is it similar to the scanner class in Java?
I don't recall, know how scanner deals with errors, which is, so I can't really say. I think overall it is, but I don't know if the error handling is. So when these failures happen, as I said, says something bad happened and then doesn't do things. So here I'm reading in a word. So reading into a string tries to read in a space delimited word. If you want to read in a line, you have to use standard getLine, which is a function that can take an IO stream and a string. So here I'm asking, did an EOF happen? And it didn't, because we didn't try to read anything. This is a common confusion. You can't use EOF to say, are we going to read an EOF when we try next? EOF only says, did we get to EOF already? And try to read there. So then we try to read, and then we get an error. And that error, in fact, is that we reached EOF. And when this read fails, it just doesn't modify the value. So our string had an old value, it keeps that old value when I type control D, because we can't read in a value. So it fails and just stops. Does that make sense? So with that, I'll move on to our next topic, which is about numbers. So we've talked a bunch about data structures. We're going to move way down to talk about how numbers are represented. And you probably have seen some hints that there's some bits involved. Talk about how bits relate to number values. And we're going to start by talking about number bases, which is just going to be pure math for a bit. So in base 10, when I write something like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, what I mean is I take, that is some good math there. Take 4 and 5. I take my 5, multiply it by 10 to the 0. Take my 4, multiply it times 10 to the 1. Take my 3, multiply it times 10 to the 2, and so on. That's how places and base 10 numbers we see work. So we have a 1's place, 10 to the 0, a 10's place, 100's place, 10 to the 2, and so on. When we have a decimal point, that means that we have the 1's place on the left side of the decimal point, and before it we have a 10th place, a 10 to the minus 1, then a 10 to the minus 2, and so on. So this is the general pattern we see with our normal base 10 numbers, decimal numbers. In this class, because we are dealing with computers, which are based on bits, we're often going to not be dealing with base 10, but some other base, usually base 2. So when I'm talking about numbers and other bases, I'm going to use one of two notations. So sometimes, for my slides, I'm mostly going to write this notation to make it where I spell out 10 or 2, and this means I'm writing a number in a different base. We'll sometimes also write out just the number 10 like this. I'm going to mostly not do that on my slides just to have some clarity about which is the base. But on our homework, for example, we're going to usually have examples where for compactness, we don't write out 10 or 11, we just write out 1, 1, 10. As a subscript like that. So here we have 20 in base 10 is equal to 11101 in base 2, allegedly, assuming I didn't make an error on this slide. And what that means is that where previously we would have something, we'd have 10 to the 0, we have 2 to the 0. Previously where we would have 10 to the 1, we'd have 2 to the 1. We just replace all those 10 to the somethings with 2 to the somethings because we changed the base from 10 to 2. And you can see the name base is the base of something we take have with an exponent. And this works with our normal number here, 1 times 2 to the 4, and so on, and with decimals. So here we have 1 and 1 fourth, and we can convert that to base 2, and we get the same sort of thing we were seeing before. We have our ones place on the left side of the I'll call it a radix point rather than a decimal point because it's not decimal. The one side of the point, and then a 2 to the minus 1 place after it, then a 2 to the minus 2's place, and so on. Exactly the same as base 10, we're just replacing all these 10 to the somethings with 2 to the somethings, even for non-integer numbers. Any questions on this? In this class, we'll deal a lot with, in fact, base 16. And I want to write out base 16 numbers, but I need more than 10 digits to do that. I have 0 through 9, but I have some other digits I want. So what I'm going to use is I'm going to use A, B, C, D, E, F. And if I want a bigger base, or I want like base 25, I'm going to keep going. So for example, 15 and base 10 is going to be F in base 16. 100 in base 10 ends up being 64 in base 16. That's 6 times 16 to the 1 plus 4 times 16 to the 0, assuming I did my math right when I made this slide. And 0.5 in base 10, that's 1/2, is going to be 0.8 in base 16. That's 8 times 16 to the minus 1, which ends up still being 1/2. Any questions about these? Yeah.
After all the letters of the alphabet are over, what comes?
After all the letters of the alphabet are over, what do you use then? We are just going to avoid that problem in this class by either specifying it if we need it or not using bases higher than 36. Okay. So C++ has integers, and in fact supports 3 different bases for numbers. So we can have base 10, we can have base 8, and we can have base 16. So base 10, you already know how to do, you just write an integer. If you start a number with a 0, it's a base 8 number, which also incidentally means you should not pad numbers with leading zeros for clarity because it changes what the number is. And if you start a number with 0x, it's a base 16 number. Yes? So the question is, can I do something like 017.4? And is that base 8? And I believe that this is a syntax error. I'm not actually sure. You shouldn't do it, I'm sure of that. But I'm pretty sure that's a syntax error. Yes?
What if you just have 0.4?
If I have 0.4, I think that's okay. That's definitely fine.
Is that base 8 or base 10?
This is base 10, sorry. So to make it base 8, I think that's how you try. I'm not sure if this is syntax error or not. The rule is that integers work this way. Reals are always base 10. That you can't do base 8 or base 16 reals in C++, at least not with syntax that is remotely close to anything we've seen. So either you're going to get base 10 number or it's a syntax error if you try to do a real number. And yes, that is confusing. You'd expect it to just work. It would be convenient if it did, but this wasn't something that people who designed C thought of, and therefore people who designed C++ and copied the syntax for constants thought of. Okay. So we have these possibilities here. This ways of writing constants, and in this class we will almost never use base 8, but it's something that exists, and we will very commonly use base 16. And it will be clear why we'd want to use base 16 over base 10 in a bit. So let's talk a bit of terminology. So when I have a base x number, the x is I can call the radix. Term. I will typically call the components of a base x number digits. You might complain that, you know, that's supposed to be a base 10 thing. You might see some people call them like radits or something like that to distinguish that. We're not going to bother with that. There's special names for digits of certain bases. The most notable one is a base 2 digit is a bit. Probably heard that before. And a base 16 digit, which you probably haven't heard this before, is sometimes called a nibble, which is basically a pun on byte. And we have special names for bases. So base 10 is decimal. Base 2 is binary. Base 8 is called octal. And base 16 is called hexadecimal. Any questions on any of these? Yeah.
So bit and nibble are the names of each component of the.
Yes, each digit of those numbers. Okay, so we've talked about bases. Let's talk about converting bases. So converting forwards is, yeah, sorry. So converting forwards is fairly simple. So here I have 4-2 in base 5, and I can just use the formula I saw earlier. We have 5 is the 5 to the 0th place, the 1's place, and 4 is in the 5 to the 1's place, and we just multiply those together and add them up. So we have 4 times 5 to the 1 plus 2 times 5 to the 0. If you're constructing this by hand, you probably start at the end so you don't miscount. And then you just do some math and get your number in base 10. And you can do the same process with 1, 2, 1 in base 3. You take 1 times 3 to the second, plus 2 times 3 to the first, plus 1 times 3 to the 0. Just do all that math out and get a number in base 10. So any questions about the forward process? So the part which usually is confusing and or annoying is converting from something that's not base 10, something to not base 10. So let's say you want to get 42 in base 10 as a base 5 number. So first you want to figure out the 1's place here. And the 1's place is going to be the remainder when we divide this number by 5. So we're going to divide by 5 because we're going to need the rest of the number later. And we're going to find the remainder, which is going to be 2. So our last digit in base 5 is a 2. And then we have the remainder, and that's going to be what's going to make up our next digits. So we take that remainder of 8, and we know 8 is 1 times 5 plus 3. So 8 times 5 is 1 times 5 to the second plus 3 times 5. So 3 is our next digit in base 5. is it's our 5 to the 1's place. And 1 is going to be our 5 to the 2's place. So we just repeatedly take the remainder to get the last digit, divide, then take the remainder from that, divide, to get each consecutive digit working from the end of the number, the least significant part of the number, the 1's place, forward. Okay, questions about this? Yes?
Is the only way to convert from one non-10 base to another non-10 base to go through 10?
The question is, can I convert from one non-base 10 base to another without going through base 10? Absolutely, because you can do all this math in not base 10. The same way you do it in base 10, you just add, and you know, you carry in the appropriate base. So that's the most straightforward way. We're going to have some special ways of doing it for particular bases that we work with a lot.